How did a little girl who grew up in an idyllic mountain town in Colorado, obsessed with outdoor sports and skiing and not doing that well at school, become one of Britain's leading media commentators and journalists? Find out soon. I'm Graham Mack, and my guest this week is the award-winning business journalist, Kate Bulkley.
This is London Calling.
This week's show is being recorded in my hometown of Liverpool. I'm putting together a special Liverpool show for you for next week. Okay, what's going on in Britain this week? Well, it's not a great time to get sick. The National Health Service is the public health service of the UK. It was set up after the Second World War on the founding principles of being comprehensive, universal, and free at the point of delivery. Today, it's in crisis. It's been a disastrous winter for the British NHS. Last week, three people died at Worcestershire Royal Hospital. One woman died of a heart attack after waiting for 35 hours on a trolley. Across the country, there are patients on trolleys due to lack of beds. Hospital trusts are on red alert and ambulances are missing targets for life-threatening emergencies. The British Red Cross has declared a humanitarian crisis in the NHS. The crazy thing is, people are still getting fertility treatment on the NHS, gastric band surgery, and even boob jobs, and all paid for by the taxpayer. Well, it's that time of year again when people in the media make predictions. The only problem is, no one can predict the future. The proof is that nobody predicted what a mess 2016 would turn out to be. But this hasn't stopped the experts in the media telling us what will happen in 2017. Now, the masters of inaccurate predictions are the fortune tellers who pretend to be scientists and work at the Met Office. They're the people in the UK who forecast the weather. Every long-term weather forecast they made for 2016 was wrong. They predicted snow and ice for what turned out to be one of the warmest Aprils on record, and we got a wet Christmas instead of the white one that they'd promised us. Not far behind the Met Office, though, are the tech gurus. For the last 10 years, they've been predicting that the next must-have gizmos will be wearable tech. So far, every attempt at getting us to wear our gadgets has failed. Google Glass was an optical head-mounted display designed in the shape of a pair of eyeglasses that was going to replace smartphones. Google Glass went on sale to the public on May the 15th, 2014. How many people do you know that bought this device? Did you ever see anyone wearing this doohickey? Google finally pulled the plug on Google Glass in January 2015, due to lack of interest. The prediction that wearable tech is the future was wrong and continues to be wrong. If you want some quiet time to yourself in a busy Apple store, go and stand at the Apple Watch table. No one will bother you. Nobody wants an extension to their iPhone with a tiny screen, not much bigger than a postage stamp, that straps to your wrist 2 inches away from where the actual iPhone is when you're holding it. My favourite tech prediction that will never come true is the one about internet shopping being delivered by drones. The media love this one, and they ignore basic truths about drones, including the fact that they can only stay in the air for a maximum of 25 minutes. So that's a 25-minute round trip. And the range is even more limited because they can't be controlled further away than 6 miles from their base. They don't even like flying in the rain, never mind snow or hail. Like a lot of people, I live in a block of flats. How will a drone be able to push the keypad with my number on it, talk to me, and wait till I push the button at my end and say, come on up? And then what will it do? Fly up the stairs? Or manage to hover in the lobby and push the button for the lift? And when it gets to my floor, How will it negotiate two fire doors and find my front door? And what if I'm not at home? Is the drone going to leave my stuff with a neighbour? The only drone we'll have in the future is the constant drone of people in the media telling us about a future that simply isn't going to happen. Let's cross to the Antarctic now, where cancer survivor Rob Smith is making his way to the South Pole. How are things going, Rob?
Things are good here. The team are very happy. We're doing great progress.
So have you made it across the plateau yet? Because that's where you were last time.
We've still got a little bit to go. We've now only got 110 kilometres to go of the plateau until we reach the pole.
How many kilometres are you averaging a day?
Around 22 kilometres. So we split that up into four sessions. First one is 2.5 hours, and then three lots of two-hour sessions.
So you should be at the South Pole within the next couple of weeks, then?
Oh, even shorter than that. So we should be there in around 4 or 6 days, with all weather good for us.
What is the temperature right now?
So we're in the sort of minus 20s. We did go up to around minus 26, 28 a couple of days ago.
Yeah.
And then when you add the wind chill onto that, it can get really, really cold. So you've got to be really careful with your fingers, your nose, ears. That can be quite challenging.
How do you take a leak?
Very, very quickly. But you have to put your back to the wind and go really quick, yeah.
Right. And what has been the biggest challenge so far, Rob?
I think it's really the cold management. All of us have got little bits of things that have happened. Keith had a little bit of snow blindness a couple of days ago.
Yeah.
I've lost my earlobe. Now it's gone black. We've all got some sores. Eric's got some sores on his fingers. And I think the other thing really is Keith's been incredible with coping with the altitude. But Eric's had a day where he was in a bit of trouble. And I've also had a few days where it's just really hard to breathe in deeply and get across the distances that we're doing.
Last time I spoke to you, you said you weren't using oxygen like Everest climbers. Do you have oxygen for emergencies?
No, we don't. We've just got to keep going. But it's really about just managing that. So we do have some tablets that we can take. The thing you do not want to get is the pulmonary edema, so the altitude sickness fully. That's where your lungs fill up. With liquids, so we don't get that. But it's incredibly dry here, so it's the driest place on the planet. So all of us have got sort of little coughs because your throat's dry most of the time.
Well, hang on in there.
We're getting, the pace is getting much better because of the sastrugi, so the waves of snow and ice are getting smaller, which means that we can move quicker and faster across. It just improves our time and get back to the tent earlier, which is good.
Well, continued success, Rob. All the best to you and Eric and Keith, and we hope we've got some great news next week when we talk to you next time.
I'll be talking to you from the South Pole next week.
That's a confident call. That's a confident call, Rob. That's very confident. I love it.
Oh, yes.
All right, then.
Yeah,
now
I'll be calling you for the South Pole.
Fantastic. Now, you're doing this for a very important cause, for Cancer Research UK. Just a reminder, if somebody wants to donate, what they got to do?
So So the easiest way is definitely just type into Google Rob Smith and set up poll, or trek2polls.com, trek2polls.com, and they can go on to fundraising and go through it straight through to my Just Giving site. I'd really appreciate anything anyone can spare. That'd be wonderful. Thank you.
Rob Smith, continued success. And we'll hear from you from the South Pole next week, because you're confident you'll be there. Thank you so much. Great to talk to you again, Rob. Glad it's going so well.
Thanks, Graham. Appreciate your time. Take care.
Let's meet this week's main guest. Her name is Kate Bulkley. She's a media commentator and journalist based in the UK with over 30 years of experience covering media, technology, telecommunications. Kate joins me on Skype now, and let's start at the beginning. Where were you born?
I was born in Motor City in Detroit, Michigan.
And what did your parents do for a living?
My father was a lawyer, and my mother was a housewife. She worked in retail for a number of years, but mostly she was a housewife. And my dad was a lawyer, and he worked actually in Detroit. He worked for a law firm that was one of the law firms that was contracted by General Motors. So like most people in Detroit in that period, he worked for the motor company, you know, for the automobile industry. Detroit was known for cars. You know, Ford was there, General Motors was there. There were a lot of them there. Of course, it isn't that way now. Detroit is going through what we hope will be a continuing renaissance, but it went through a pretty bad time when the car industry started to move overseas. But of course, now that we have President Trump, who knows, maybe that will all come back. Manufacturing will just be magicked up again and it'll all be fine. But anyway.
How many brothers and sisters?
I have a younger brother. That's it.
Right. And you're still, is he still in the United States?
Yeah. He lives outside of Boston, and he basically is in the renovations business. He does a lot of work with sort of taking houses that have been a little bit sad and neglected and spruces them up and either sells them or rents them.
What were you into as a kid?
Well, we left Detroit when I was five. So my what I remember is growing up in Colorado.
Okay.
What I remember from that period was snow and skiing and very much outdoors activities, because that's one of the reasons my dad left. He didn't particularly like Detroit that much. He'd always been a much more of an outdoors type person. So when his mother died, because he grew up in Detroit, and his father had died a lot earlier. When his mother died, he sort of felt that he was free to move the family. So that's when we moved to Colorado.
So he just chose Colorado for the lifestyle.
He chose Colorado because even when he was in grade school and eventually in university, he would go on ski trips. You know, kind of keep in mind, this was in the, you know, sort of 40s. And skiing in the 40s was not the way it is now. There were sort of rope tows pulled by, you know, engines that would make the rope go around in circles, and you'd grab on the rope and get to the top. And skis were pretty basic. There was, they were wooden skis with leather straps that would hold them on, safety straps, and the bindings were what we call percussion bindings. You pulled them down and they snapped in, and it was all pretty basic. And but he loved it. He thought it was fantastic. And so he had heard about Aspen from a friend of his that he had gone to university with. And he said, you should go check this place out. And so my father moved the family there in 1963, when it was really a very simple ski town with one paved road and lots of people who had gotten there because they had left Europe, escaping the Nazis and other bad things, and had sort of set up shop there. So we had lots of Austrians and Germans and people that loved the mountains. And so it was a wonderful place to grow up. We had restaurants like the Wiener Stube, which was obviously a Viennese type name for a restaurant because it was, you know, run by a Viennese. I remember one of our first friends, and still friends to this day, the father of whom had escaped from the Nazis, sent his children to Australia. They had then sort of refound each other. They met in New York, and they ended up in Aspen, owned a lodge. Charlie, who was my mother's age, was a ski instructor, so my childhood was spent in what I would call an idyllic mountain town, and there was a lot of outdoor sports.
So where did your passion for media come from?
What happened to me is I wasn't really doing very well in school. My parents sort of thought, well, you know, maybe she's a nice girl, but not that smart. So, you know, that's fine. And then one day they put me in the private school in Aspen. And I just got excited about learning. I think it was because I had smaller classes and teachers that cared. So because they were both from, my mother was from the East Coast. She was from New Jersey. And my father was from Michigan, but had been educated on the East Coast. They both felt that it was probably a good idea to send me away to school, to find a good school that would cater to my, let's say, interest that they really saw in being, you know, a little bit more than just a happy-go-lucky ski bunny. So I went away to school and to boarding school when I was 13 in the South, in Virginia. And of course, the thing about America is a lot of people do move from, you know, pillar to post. We do move around a bit. So I was born in Michigan, grew up in Colorado, went to high school in Virginia. I then went to college outside of Boston in Massachusetts. I then went to graduate school in Italy, and then I went to I finished my graduate program in Washington D.C. So I've lived in a lot of different places in the States. But I think that the media thing happened rather late for me, in the sense that I had been a history major. I really loved history. I loved European history, in fact, and ended up majoring in it in college. And when I got to the end of my university degree, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. Keep in mind, this was sort of the 80s, and there was lots of sort of jobs in banking and things like that, and that didn't really appeal to me. And so I sort of thought, well, what am I going to do? And so one of my teachers said, well, you might want to go on and just get a master's. So I ended up doing a master's degree that sent me to Italy. And I lived in Italy for about a year and a half for the first part of my master's program, which was with the Johns Hopkins University, the School of Advanced International Studies, which is called SAIS. That's how they that's the acronym for it. And that really sealed the deal for me. I thought, I love Europe. I want to get back here somehow. And so when I came back to finish my degree, still not quite knowing what I wanted to do, I was in Washington, D.C., and I remember I walked into the office of the lady who was sort of in charge of the alumni relations and things like that. And she put out a magazine in that era. And she said, well, since you don't really know what you want to do, why don't you go out and interview some women who've, you know, graduated with your degree over the past, you know, years, and just see what they do. And, you know, you can write it up, maybe you'll find something. Mm-hmm. So I said, okay, that's a good idea. So I went out and interviewed all these ladies, very different ages, very different industries. Some of them were working for the Defense Department. There was one in banking, as I recall. There was one who was in the oil and gas industry. So, you know, I sort of crossed the board.
And were you recording these interviews or writing them down?
No, it was sort of pre that kind of stuff. I remember just writing them down, handwriting, because I was really basically still a student at that time. I was just finishing my master's, and I finished it, the article, and I remember vividly, Graham, in my mind, unpacking the boxes when the magazines arrived. You know, this is the era of, you know, old media, traditional print, none of this internet stuff. And, you know, unwrapping them, and there was my name, you know, on the cover saying I'd done the story. And I remember her name was Sue Crowley. I remember she looked at me and she said, well, you know, did you find your answer? I said, well, no, I didn't actually find my answer. But, you know, it was a lot of fun doing that. She goes, well, have you ever thought about journalism?
Wow.
And I literally, you know, actually, no, I haven't. So that was the beginning of that. So it took me a long time to find journalism. But after that, it was a pretty straight shot. I ended up working for... ended up basically an internship at what was then called Cable News Network.
Right.
We now know it as CNN.
Yeah.
Cable News Network was just really starting up in that era.
And was that in Atlanta?
Well, it was in Atlanta, but they had an office, obviously, in Washington. They had a bureau. So the Washington, D.C. bureau was obviously all about the State Department and that kind of stuff. And, of course, that fed right into my master's degree, which was in international relations. So I ended up, again, through this lady, Sue Crowley, said, why don't you just find out if they have any internships? So I marched down to the CNN, or Cable News Network, it was known then, office, and basically volunteered. And they gave me the horrible shift. My shift was like, I think it was 2 a.m. in the morning till 6 a.m. in the morning. It was one of those sort of overnight shifts. Now, keep in mind, cable news network at that point was the first 24-hour news network. You know, yeah. Ted Turner had pioneered this idea. People thought he was mad, right? You know, he's just a completely off his rocker. Who watch news 24 hours of the day was what people were saying. And, of course, that wasn't what the idea was. The idea was you could dip in and out. But anyway, so we were actually trying to pump out, we meaning CNN, was trying to pump out a 24-hour-a-day news channel, which, of course, in that era was, you know, brand new. And so, to make a long story short, I worked there, and I was doing literally, and this just shows you how much journalism has changed, Graham. I mean, I was actually ripping wires. We had a wire room. I mean, wire rooms don't even exist anymore, but in the old days, you know, back in the 80s, you still had machines that went da-da-da-da-da-da, and they would type out the news. So yeah. There'd be API, UPI, you know, AP, Dow Jones was
Reuters, yeah.
And they were punching, you know, say corn prices down, you know, or, you know, bomb just gone off somewhere. And then the room was this noisy, horrible place. So you'd go in there and you rip the wire off and then you'd look at it and you would say, which reporter should this go to? And you'd run over to the reporter and put it on his desk. Most of them were men on his desk. And then they would write a story and off you go and it would be on air. Well, I did that for a while. And then one night, because keep in mind, I'm in this graveyard shift. One night, one of the overnight anchors who came in was the guy who was State Department correspondent. His name was Ralph Begleiter. I mean, I remember him, you know, just bigger than life. And he was basically had been assigned to read, you know, the news overnight, you know, sort of because, again, it was a 24-hour news station. Now, Ted Turner didn't believe in labor unions. So basically, as an intern, as somebody who was just helping out, I was allowed to do everything. So I was running cameras. And in that era, you had to actually move the camera. You know, it wasn't automatic.
Yeah.
And you actually had to run the teleprompter. So that the type would go in, but somebody had to turn it so that.
Yeah.
And so you had to time the teleprompter to how the presenter was reading, how fast or slow the presenter was reading. So it was actually a fairly important job. Anyway, so one night I get assigned to Ralph, who's a State Department correspondent, but he's there filling in for somebody who was there. That's one of his rotations. So I knew he was the State Department correspondent. So I, of course, went up to him during the break, and I said, you know, you need me to come help you at the State Department because I'm doing a master's in international relations. You need me. And he said, I don't take interns. Thank you very much, but, you know, I don't need you. I really don't need you. But, you know, thank you. So we went to the next thing, and I again scrolled his teleprompter, and then we had the next break. And I said, "You sure you don't need me? I'd be very helpful. I mean, I'm studying European history, and I'm doing this and da, da." He says, "You're also running my teleprompter, aren't you?" And I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "All right, I'll tell you what. You're doing a pretty good job. You can come out with me on a shoot, you know, in 2 days or whenever it was, and I'll pick you up, and we'll go out, and we'll see how it goes." Okay, I said. So I remember he picked me up. Early in the morning, I remember it was raining, horrible. We went out to the one of the airfields where they used to land. I'm not sure they still do this, but where they land the diplomatic planes. Uh-huh. And we all lined up. Now, keep in mind, this is in the era when CNN was, you know, at the bottom of the pecking chain. So, you know, everybody else was in front of us. I mean, there was, you know, there was the Washington Post. There was ABC, NBC, UPI, I mean, everybody, and then us. There was Ralph and me right at the end. And what they did in those days, I don't know if they do this anymore, but the dignitary, who in this case was the Saudi Arabian ambassador, right, to the United States, got, you know, the plane landed, he got out, walked down the steps, he had his, you know, dish dash on, the whole thing, with his entourage, and he came down the line and met the press corps, the Washington press corps.
Right.
So he was going down the line saying hello to these people, and, you know, they were saying a few words, and he gets to Ralph, and Ralph says, "Hello, I'm the, you know, I'm the State Department correspondent for Cable News Network. Very nice to meet you, you know, sir, and, you know, we hope you have a good time. We were going to have a press conference after this." He gets to me, and I say, "Hi, I'm Kate Bulkley, and I'm a student at Johns Hopkins School for Advanced International Studies." And he looked at me, and he goes, "Oh, are you by chance, are you studying with Professor Ajami?" And I said, "Well, yes, actually, I just took a course with him, who was a Middle East specialist." And he goes, "You know, I know Professor Ajami." So he starts talking to me.
Right.
Pretty soon, people at the top end are looking down the line. Who's the girl at the end? Right? Why is he talking to the girl at the end? Anyway, so we finally get into the hangar to do this press conference. And, of course, I remember it was about oil prices, as it would be. And we get in, and everybody's slammed into this place. You know, he's way up in front. They've got the lights on. There's a couple of camera crews. And I'm behind Ralph, literally, you know, up against him because it was so full. I'm literally, you know, can't even see because he's a big man. I'm sort of trying to see over his back. So they, you know, he says, okay, we'll take questions. And hands went up. And suddenly Ralph says, get in front of me and put your hand up. So I get in front of him and I put my hand up. And of course, the guy says, the blonde in the back. So I don't know what to ask. So Ralph whispers in my ear the question, which was something about oil prices. I don't even remember what it was. And so we got our soundbite, right?
Great.
And Ralph turned to me. We walked out. And Ralph turned and says, you can come work with me at the State Department.
And that was the start of it.
That was the start of my journalism career.
So how did you get to the UK?
Well, like I said, I wanted to get back to Europe. I had that as part of my, you know, modus operandi. So the CNN thing, you know, kind of went on for a while. I then graduated. I needed to have more sort of what I would call basic training in journalism. In fact, I remember the guy who ran the CNN bureau's office. His name was, I can't remember his first name. His last name was Headline. I think it was.
No, that was his real name?
That was his real name. And I remember he said to me, keep in mind, I'm a kid, right? I'm, you know, and he said to me, he said, you know, Katie, I think you need to go back to a smaller market and, you know, learn the craft. Okay. So so off I went and I thought, well, what's my local market? Well, Colorado. So I went back to Colorado and I ended up working for something called the Denver Business Journal, which I think is still around. It was at that time owned by American City Business Newspapers. I can't believe I'm bringing this out of the back of my head. And it was I was hired as a cub reporter. So I was the youngest reporter on the staff. I was the only girl on the reporting staff. And, I was given the beats. This is in Denver. I was given the beats that nobody really wanted because the boys all felt that the important beats were real estate, healthcare, banking, you know, those kind of things. And I was given the things they didn't want, which was, retail, high tech, telecommunications, and I did a little bit of legal reporting, so sort of big legal cases, but basically high tech mm-hmm. and telecommunications they didn't want because it was sort of like it was all new. And we had companies like we had the regional headquarters for Sprint and MCI in Denver. We also had a bunch of cable television companies, as they were then known as, all based in Denver. Mm-hmm. Why were all these big cable companies based in Denver? Because cable television at that time had been basically an answer to a problem, i.e. if you couldn't get broadcast signals, because remember, America's quite big,
yeah.
And if you had mountains and things in the way, you couldn't get signals. So people started building cable companies, so they were actually sending it on a pipe. And a lot of those companies, for one reason or another, were headquartered in Denver. So you know, me, cub reporter, I ended up covering all these companies. Many of them don't exist anymore, but it was Jones, it was TCI, which became Liberty Global, Liberty Media. It was United Cable International, I think they were called. I mean, there were a whole bunch of them. And I was cool. And there was also a whole big software business, which still exists, which is part of Boulder, because of the University of Colorado. So all those companies were there. So I basically worked as a reporter for them for, four and a half, five years. Ended up becoming the senior reporter. Ended up breaking stories nationally about the cable television business.
Was Mr. Headline right? Did you need to go to the smaller market?
Oh, yeah, I think so, definitely. For me, it was great because I went back not to TV. I went back to journalism, actually writing, because Business Journal was a print publication. And for me, that was great. I mean, I remember my editors there. They taught me so much. I mean, one of the things that I think is unfortunate now with journalism is that because it's all so fast, the news cycles are so fast. It's all about, you know, internet, you know, doing something immediately, tweeting, blogging, vlogging, that you don't get time to actually sit back and think about a story and actually – you know, have time to assess and maybe investigate a little further and all that kind of stuff. So for me, it was a great training ground. Since it was a business news paper, I really started to get into business news. I sort of veered away from politics and stuff and got more into business. And that's where I've stayed. I've actually really enjoyed covering business, entrepreneurs, new technologies, and how they affect the businesses that I cover. So it's So yeah, it was a great training ground. I mean, I do not regret it at all. It was definitely the right move.
So how did that get you to the UK?
So I was breaking these stories about cable, some of which went national in the sense that they were picked up by companies like, you know, the Wall Street Journal and, you know, big business newspapers that were very prestigious for the Denver Business Journal. And I thought, well, maybe this is the moment when I need to think about my next move. So I thought, well, who can get me to Europe fastest? I mean, if I go and try to apply for the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, I mean, they'll probably want me to work in the States for 10 years before they send me abroad, because those are considered fairly plum jobs.
Yeah. And you've got this Europe thing. You've got to get there.
I wanted to get to Europe. So I looked around. I thought, well, what can I do? So I ended up applying for jobs at Women's Wear Daily, which is obviously a retail publication, a company called Variety, which is a big trade that writes about the entertainment business.
Yeah.
And another one that I hadn't actually heard of before, but they were called Cable World. It was a Cable World. Sorry, Cable World. And all three of those were trades. So they were, you know, they were B2B publications, business to business. And I thought, well, I'll have more opportunity to move up faster. That was my theory. So anyway, to make a long story short, I didn't get a job at Variety. I didn't get a job at Women's Wear Daily, but Cable World took me up on, you know, my application, and I walked in there, and I remember meeting the publisher, whose name is Tom Southwick, and he's still actually in the industry today. And he said to me, you know, we'd love to have you because we need to cover more business in our cable thing. And I said, well, I'm your girl because I cover business. And I said, you know, I'll set up your business section, but I really want to get overseas. And, you know, one of the stories that I just wrote was about this little company called US West, which doesn't exist anymore. It's now Quest, I think. But anyway, it was one of the regional Bell companies, had just done a deal to start a cable system or to invest in a cable system that they were going to build in Hong Kong. And this was like sort of the beginning of US cable companies moving outside of the US in order to basically think about cable in a different way. So it wasn't just about television. It was also about telecommunications and broadband and telephone and all that kind of stuff. And they were able to do that outside, and they weren't at the time in the US because of certain regulations that were in place. So I had written that story, and I said, you know, there's stuff happening internationally. You should be covering it. And that would give you an edge over all your competitors out there. And he bought it. So he said, okay, great. 6 months here, you set up our business coverage, and then we'll send you abroad. And that's exactly what it is. So I ended up in England in 1990, I think it was, as this, you know, the correspondent, the internet, the first and only correspondent for Cable World magazine. And it was great. I had great fun. So that's how I got here.
And where were you staying? Did they put you up and look after you, or were you like had to fend for yourself?
Pretty much had to fend for myself. The good news was that one of the investors in Cable World was a guy named Paul Kagan, and Paul Kagan already had an office here. He's a California. Basically, he was writing investment letters that he was selling to people for lots of money. And he had an office here that was doing some research because he also saw that there was a lot happening in cable and broadband in this country. I mean, this was at a time when Maggie Thatcher had basically decided, the prime minister at the time, had decided that there wasn't enough competition to BT, to British Telecom, as then. And so cable and wireless hadn't really done it. And so she had decided to franchise out cable in the UK. Yeah. And basically allow people to come in and build competing networks that would compete with BT and Cable and Wireless. And a lot of those networks that were funded and built at the time were built with a lot of US money.
Yeah.
I mean, people like 9X, Southwestern Bell, they were all the big telcos were over here. A lot of the big media companies were over here. I mean, one of the sort of the Comcast had some money over here in early days in Cambridge with the Cambridge cable system. And it was a very interesting time. So it made sense for somebody like me to be over here because there were all these expat Americans building cable systems over here.
Yeah. And you understood the business. Yeah.
And I understood the business, and it was a lot of fun. So it was a little scary. I think if I'd known how scary it was going to be, I probably wouldn't have done it. But, you know, I was young and it seemed exciting, and it was hard. But because, you know, the other thing was I had a time difference because Denver was 7 hours time difference. Yeah. So I'd have to go through almost my entire day without anybody.
Yeah.
And then I would call my editor at sort of 4 o'clock in the afternoon my time, and he would just be getting into the office, and I'd say, well, this is what I found out. What do you want me to do? You know? So it was talk about self-starter. You had to be a self-starter. But it was fun.
And what was the biggest culture shock?
Yeah, I mean, at the time, it was a very different place. I mean, at the time, in 1990, 1991, I mean, my goodness, you know, things were closed in the afternoon. They weren't open on the weekends. There were funny trading hours. There was all this, you mean, you couldn't get lunch in a pub after a certain time because of the licensing laws. I mean, it was all that kind of stuff was really strange for an American who was used to kind of more of a service-based economy. So I remember that was a little bit shocking. The weather got to me because, of course, I'd come from Colorado, which had sort of wonderful weather. And so sort of the amount of kind of drizzly stuff was and sort of raininess was difficult. We're moving into that period now. So I remember that was sort of hard as well. But I think most of it was just trying to set up a whole new network of people from nothing, you know, from just set up your whole contact base from nothing. And luckily I met some very nice people early on who, you know, some people that were working as interns actually in the Kagan office who were doing their graduate degrees at the London School of Economics. And so we kind of palled around with them and I, you know, eventually built a network, but it wasn't easy, but it was a wonderful experience. And of course I was able to travel. I ended up setting up stringers all over the world. So I had, in the end, by the end of the 4 years or 5 years that I was with Cable World, I had stringers in Tokyo. I had somebody in Hong Kong. I had somebody in Geneva. Where else did I have people? And they were all filing to me stories and then I would put them together and then throw them towards Denver and they would get in the magazine. So it was a lot of fun.
And what were your first impressions of British people? I'm guessing this was in London itself, was it?
Yes, in London. Yeah, I was always in London.
Yeah. And now London, It's a cosmopolitan city, but it has a reputation for sometimes not being as friendly as maybe some more regional areas. What were your first impressions of the people that you met and you were working
with? Well, keep in mind, the only other time I'd lived abroad for an extensive period was in Italy.
Yeah.
Now, the Italians and the Brits are pretty different in terms of kind of, you know, in terms of welcomingness and open arm policy. So, you know, whereas Italians were very warm and Southern European and, you know, bene, come with me and, you know, blah, blah. The Brits were a little bit, well, you know, if you didn't go to my school, I'm not really sure that I want to talk to you. So there was a bit of that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that's part of that's just the culture. And I mean, what's funny now, actually, having lived here now for over 25 years, is that when I come back to America, not so much to New York or, you know, the coast, but if I go into the interior, go to Virginia or Michigan, and you know, I it's almost like the friendliness kind of overwhelms me. I'm almost become British. I'm a little bit more standoffish, you know. I'll be standing in a line in a queue at a bank or something, and somebody will start talking to me. I don't even know who they are, and I'm thinking, why are you talking to me? Because it wouldn't happen in London, you know. So it was, you know, very funny. So it is. There are certain cultural differences.
Did you notice the class system? Were you aware of that?
Well, I'll tell you one funny story. Again, the cable business was just, you know, really starting up, and there were lots of American companies who were sending people over to try to set up these companies, and they had to have boards of directors and all that kind of thing. And so because they were trying to sort of make sure they worked inside the system, a lot of them were hiring sort of aristocracy type folks to help them as their board members. A lot of these were older men for the most part. Mm-hmm. So I ended up, I remember when I had a conversation with my boss about this, my editor, I said, Stuart, I really need to have the ability to take people to lunch. He goes, that's great. I understand you can do that. And I said, but you know, there's something I need to do. And I need to like start ingratiating myself with some of these people who are on the boards of these companies so I can understand what's going on, because the Americans know certain things, but the Brits know other things. And the Brits tend to be on the boards, and a lot of them tend to be like of the aristocracy. So I started a program, and it was actually a line item on my expense report once a month. And it was called the Take a Lord to Lunch program.
Like it.
And so I would basically target somebody who was on somebody's board of some cable company, and I would make sure I could have lunch with him, and, you know, I'd pay for it. And of course, they thought that was wonderful. And I would try to get more information about what was going on with the business I was trying to cover.
Well, it was actually at that time, it was actually a rule. I don't know about other media. I only really know about radio. But at that time, radio stations, their boards had to have at least one lord on the board of the radio station.
You know, that was probably what it was then, because they all seemed to have them. So that was probably what, if there was a law, then it was probably extended to, because cable is a communication industry. So
it was. It was a law. I worked at a radio station in Bournemouth, not until it was in 1997 when the law had gone. But as a hangover from that, the chairman of the radio station was Lord Stokes, who is a bloke who famously, some say, ran the British car industry into the ground. But he had retired to Bournemouth, this seaside resort on the south coast, and found himself as the chairman of the radio station. He knew absolutely nothing about radio.
Kate Bulkley, more from her next week, and a special Liverpool show. In the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Graham Mac. If you want to hear more Mac Nuggets, check out my website, macmedia.co.uk, and subscribe to my Bob FM show on iTunes. Got a question or something to say? Send me an email. If you put your phone number in the email, I might call you back or Skype you on the show. My email address, graham@macmedia.co.uk. And you spell Graham like the cracker, Mac like the truck. Till next week. Ta-da.